The Talk of the Northwest, The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good morning. You're very welcome along to The Greg Hughes Show here on Highland Radio. And we have lots coming up for you over the course of the next 2 hours. We will be kicking off things very shortly with our Friday panel, but we want to invite you to join the conversation as well, of course. 0860 25000, that's the WhatsApp and the text number, 0860 25000, or give us a call on 07491 25000, or email if you prefer, comments at highlandradio.com. And you can watch the programme as you can every single morning. You can go onto YouTube, Highland Radio Ireland, watch across your mobile devices and on your smart TV and Fire Stick. And we're on Facebook as well. Do hope you're all well. Right, let's say good morning to our Friday panel. Niamh McGuinness is Ogra Sinn Féin representative, joins us now. Good morning to you. Thank you so much for your time.
Morning, Greg. Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you with us. We have Professor Pat O'Connor, Emeritus Professor of Sociology and Social Policy at the University of Limerick. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Craig.
And we also have Minister Marion Harkin, Minister of State at the Department of Further and Higher Education, Research, Innovation and Science. Marion, it's great to have you on the programme. Thanks for making yourself available.
Thanks, Greg. Great to be on and nice to see three women.
Yes, well, you wouldn't want to have tuned in last week because whatever was happening last week, there was no females available for the panel. But these things are scheduled well in advance. It wasn't due to a lack of intent. I suppose first up, Marion, and I'll start with you. What can or should the government do right now to address the rapidly rising cost of fuel? Every time you wake up, there's some hope it's come down to $90 a barrel, then it's over 100 again because there's a certain incident. But it's really got us at the pin of our collar in terms of, you know, buying diesel, particularly home heating oil. What would you like to see government do?
Well, look, you're quite right about it. The situation is very fluid. It's very uncertain. We've spikes, and the next day we hear that the price of oil has come down per barrel, I think, from 120 to 90. And the day after that, it's gone back up to 105. So the situation is very dynamic. What your listeners are interested in is in hearing how it impacts them, their pocket, their family, their home heating oil, their diesel, their petrol, whatever. And of course, it will feed in, as we know, to the cost of items in your local supermarket elsewhere, because of the cost of transport. We're an island, so all of this, you know, matters very much to us. So the question you asked me, though, is more specific than that. It's what can be done. Well, first of all, let me say what has been done, and I'm not talking about a couple of months ago. I'm just talking about in very recent days. Many of your listeners will know that the allowance for the fuel allowance has now been extended to quite a number of families for the working family payment. Something like in Donegal itself, nearly 2,500 families who were not receiving the fuel allowance beforehand, receiving it now. They've been back paid to the 1st of January and they will be paid from now on. And for those families, that will be a significant shift. And I think, to be fair,
can I just say one thing, though, in relation to that, Marion? That would have been very welcome, and it is very welcome, of course, and credit where it's due, but that would have taken some of the burden off €500 for 500 litres of oil. Now it's going against 850, 900 euro for 500 litres of oil. So you can see how quickly that is consumed in it. Do you not believe there is some sort of an argument at this point for a suspension of at least some of the tax on fuel until such time as there's some stability for consumers?
Well, I know that the government are actually examining all options. Some people want to see the carbon tax rid of entirely, which is something. Even as a member of the opposition, last time around, it would have been very easy for me to say no to every tax from the government. But even as a member of the opposition, I never once because I recognise the value of it. The value of the carbon tax means that for I won't say the first time, but one of the first times, a tax is ring-fenced. Because most people, when their tax is paid, where does it go? So it's ring-fenced. Ring-fenced for those people on fuel allowance. It's ring-fenced for farmers and others. So in that sense, as a tax, it's a progressive and a good tax. But your question is, in the current context, what do we do about that? And I believe myself that the government is very open to seeing what needs to be done. It's assessing the situation. It is less than 2 weeks since the war started in Iran. And when I say the war, there are many wars throughout the world, but I'm speaking about that one. And I think they're assessing to see what's the best way forward and how to react to this.
Yeah. Do you have a proposition in relation to that? Or what would you like to see happen?
Well, of course, what I would like to see and what the government will do may be different, maybe the same.
But you're an advantage on this call because you're the only one with any influence, right? So what would you like to see done?
Yeah. Well, look, from my own perspective, I think the hauliers have a very significant concern at the moment, not just in regard to the increase in the cost of fuel. I know because I've met them on many occasions, and they're the people who supply us with the goods we need, make sure those people remain in business. So I think government needs to look at some kind of package for the haulage industry, because that's what impacts on the cost in the supermarket, etc. Okay. As far as individuals, families are concerned, I do think the extension of the fuel allowance has made a real difference. I think the government has maintained the VAT rate at 9%. It decreased it. That has made a real difference. And I think government will...
Before I bring our other guests in, and I'm very keen to do so, 65% of the take on fuel is taxes, taxes of one form or another. Surely there should be a system in place whereby, at least in a crisis, you know, this is carbon taxes are about protecting the planet. The Middle East is on fire at the moment. God knows what impact that's having on the environment. Surely, would you not support some sort of a mechanism that those taxes could be suspended to try and take some of the pressure off? I mean, the state should not be benefiting to the tune of 38 million euro because there's a war in the Middle East.
Not the benefit. It's the people who benefit from that specific tax that you mentioned, the carbon tax. It's the farmers. It's those who are trying to upgrade their homes through different SEAI programs to make their homes warmer. It's the people who are on fuel allowance. So it's not the state. In fact, in that specific instance, that's benefit. It's the people, because it's the people's money. But I do understand the broader point you're making, that the level of taxation in this country on fuel is very high. And in a situation like this, the government have said they won't be found wanting. And I sincerely hope that is the case. However, whichever taxation, I think maybe excise, that's only my personal opinion. It has no more weight. But I think that's maybe where they might look. But again, just me.
Right, I understand. Pat O'Connor, Professor Pat O'Connor, what's your view?
Well, I mean, I noticed that the tarnish there really was dithering, really. The budget did not support families, it supported industry. Now the government is in a very tricky situation because this is a crisis. Okay, nobody knows how long the crisis will go on. But for people such as single parent families, for those who are disabled, a matter of 2 weeks is a lot to basically be left footing bills. So really, I think the government needs to take emergency action, defining it as in terms of weeks rather than months. But clearly, I think something needs to be done, whether it's carbon tax or excise tax. But basically, home heating situation, you know, saying it's only early days. If you're in a freezing cold situation, then a couple of weeks is a lot. The fuel allowance to households in receipt of working working families, that was a belated attempt to basically shore up government support, recognising that the budget had not
but
been
But it helped. Is there, Pat, you know, and when something
yes,
is there,
it is
it's there.
There yeah. But it's not enough. And in a way, I think the government still haven't got their head around the fact that this is a crisis situation, and it does reflect badly on the government, which really has not been working.
Yeah, but every action has a reaction. If we were to suspend some of these carbon taxes or something, that money, you know, would not be there then for your retrofitting and for the there is an argument though, should fuel supports be coming from an additional tax when there's a big tax base there, but that's a different conversation potentially. But my point being is you suspend that and the pot does get smaller for the things Minister Harkin was referencing.
Yes, this is an emergency. Incidentally, I would be extremely critical of the amount of expenditure on SEAI, which I have found personally extremely unhelpful and really an overfunded administrative structure staffed by people who are meant to be experts and aren't. But that is another story. But I think as an emergency act, there needs to be a matter of putting in place measures for a number of weeks, not even months.
Okay, let's bring in Niamh McGuinness, Ogra Sinn Féin rep. Your party has a particular position on this, but I mean, I'm interested in your views as well. I wouldn't be surprised if they align.
Yeah, well, I'd actually like to first comment on how, you know, we're hearing the government has expanded the fuel allowance. And I'd like to think that a lot of your listeners, Greg, would agree with me this morning that this step is, of course, it's welcome, but it's not nearly enough for households. It doesn't solve the pressure almost nearly as much as it's aiming to in regards to families that are commuting. You know, we're in a big county and we're vastly rural. Families need their cars to commute, take their kids to school. Our homes are largely oil heated. You know, the expanded fuel allowance simply isn't enough. And what I found is that, I'm sure what we've all found, is that the government always moves late once families have already taken the hit.
Yeah, just in relation to that fuel allowance, and I know it's been broadened out, and as I say, credit where it is due, this crisis that we're in at the moment, though, is catching an awful lot of people. Most of those, many of those, are beyond sort of the entitlement of that. Regular families who, you know, I say regular families, I think we know what we're saying. There's no regular family, but, you know, mum and dad out working or dad or mum out working or whatever the combination might be, you know, not necessarily what you might call living in poverty, but now all of a sudden heating the home is not possible. And as I say, that goes beyond maybe those that might receive the fuel allowance. Your party, Sinn Féin, has an emergency or has emergency legislation in relation to that. I presume you're endorsing that.
Oh, absolutely. What we'd be calling on the government to do is cut excise duty on petrol, diesel, home heating oil. We're calling on for the scrap, the planned carbon tax increase completely. We don't need to be pushing people further into fuel poverty and then trying to explain to them why this is a benefit to them. We're seeing that it's not a benefit to them. And we need for the VAT on home heating oil to be reduced to the same 9% rate applied to all electricity and gas. There needs to be a full investigation on price gouging. You know, families can't afford to wait for these things to take action. We need it now, Greg.
A caller says, 1998 sent a litre this morning in Donegal. I'm only driving the truck and it almost made me cry. I'll be out of a job if this gets much worse. They're saying the government is assessing the situation. Well, we are 2 weeks into the assessment and there's nothing happening. The government is trying to get 100 million euro for Ukraine. We're just holding out until the next election to get the current government out. I will say, and I don't want to sound like a scratched record, there is plenty in the pot, remarkably, to support Ukraine, whether you want them or not. If the government sends 100 million to Ukraine, it doesn't influence or has zero impact on their ability to work with excise duty or whatever it might be. A caller says, we've tolerated a lot of abuse and price pressure from this government, so we deserve all we get. Another, I remember the last time they wanted to lower the tax and were told they needed permission from the EU, European Union, hold all the power. It happened during the beginning of the war in Ukraine. That's certain elements of the tax. Other elements of the tax, there is a we do have some control over. With the Taoiseach preparing for the traditional White House shamrock ceremony, the question can be, how can the government reconcile a diplomatic visit to an administration whose missiles have recently been linked to the deaths of hundreds of school children in Minab, as well as the ongoing catastrophe in Gaza? Furthermore, in light of reports that the Irish yesterday, that the Irish firms are committing over $6 billion in new capital investment in the US economy, is our influence in Washington truly about peace and human rights, or is the St. Patrick's Day tradition effectively become a commercial trade mission? And that requires Ireland to remain silent on state-sponsored violence. What say you, Niamh McGuinness?
It's a tough one, isn't it, Greg? I suppose Ireland absolutely should engage internationally. But that engagement cannot mean silence on the issue of human rights and international breaches of international law, especially when you're interacting and greeting and playing nice, I suppose, with an administration that has now been linked to the killing of school-age children in Minab. We've seen the absolute devastation in Gaza. And we have a duty as a nation to speak up about peace, about human rights, staying within international law. And our relationship with Washington should never require moral cowardice. And if that's what it takes for us to go over and meet with President Trump and share with him a bowl of shamrocks, then I would seriously question our role on the international stage. At a minimum, I think any engagement should be used to publicly and also privately press for peace and accountability and end to the slaughter of civilians.
But where does it end? You know, if we were then to qualify for the World Cup, for an example, do you not go and play in the World Cup in the United States? You can't sort of be a little bit moral on it, can you? I mean, where does that sort of trajectory take you?
No, I agree, and I'd reiterate my point that you can't show, there can't be limits to your morality or show cowardice in the face of maybe what you might stand to gain. At the minute, we're looking at thousands of dead women and children, and this is now spanning all across the Middle East.
Yeah, the problem is that we're hosting Keir Starmer at the moment in Cork, and you could argue that the British are as complicit in what was allowed happening in Gaza as the United States, albeit not supplying necessarily directly as many weapons.
Yeah. I think just the point that we have to focus on at the minute now as we're approaching St. Patrick's Day is we're going over for a grand show, a nice big dinner, and lots of friendly pictures to be taken, and there's hard conversation to be had rather than what we know we'll see in the papers next week.
If it were a vote, a single vote, would you vote for the Taoiseach not to attend the White House?
I would like for the Taoiseach to go over and look out for the best interests and to stick up for international law and human rights. And if I knew for absolute certainty that we would have a Taoiseach that were advocate for us and stand for what we believe in, absolutely go over. It is well worth our time. I don't think we shouldn't be in Washington. We have a place there. But I can't say for certainty. I'd nearly bet that that's not what's going to happen.
And I think your answer there talks to the complexity of the situation. Professor Pat O'Connor, is it as cut and dry with you? Or is it more cut and dry with you, sorry?
I mean, I agree with Niamh. It's a very tricky situation, right? I mean, I suppose the way I see it, international law is actually being undermined. And if international law is gone, then in a way we're in a world which, you know, it's the bully and the thug rule. It's extremely serious. We're on the brink of World War III. Trump, the president of the United States, is volatile, It is extremely difficult. It appears to be extremely difficult to have a reasonable argument with them, to have a reasonable discussion even with them. I agree with Niamh that in a way, I suppose I always think keeping channels open is important. And really, the Patrick's Day event has never been simply about peace. It has always had a commercial end to it. So actually, but I do think that we do need that the Prime Minister, that Micheál Martin, does need to actually make some hard points. Mm. I think it's very difficult for him to do that, particularly given
but
the
you say
person
all of
he's
that,
dealing
really,
with.
But when you say all of that, really, though, what we're trying to do is protect ourselves financially. Look at the Spanish. The Spanish have taken a very principled opposition to what the United States have done. Our diplomatic channel still open, I presume, is back channel and going, yes, but their people, the people of Spain, could be satisfied that their government has taken a principled stand in relation to what is happening in the Middle East. Yet here we are, you know, at regular folk, I think we are regular folk, sort of humming and hawing and going, oh, because we don't want to lose that. We don't want to lose those billions, do we? We don't want to lose those billions of foreign direct investment. So we're all culpable.
We are in a way, but I do think, I mean, the government should pass the Occupied Territories Bill. You know, it's not only on this that the government is stalling and is. We are, but we have
but
always
the Occupied
been.
Territories Bill is significant, don't get me wrong. But in the wider scale of where we're at, would it even make page one of a newspaper at this point, given the flux in the world?
But in a way, your point, Drake, is that we're actually dealing with our own moral cowardice and our own slipperiness, which is both our strength and our weakness. So I suppose, I mean, I recognise that. I recognise that. I do wish, I do want a little more courage. I admire Spain. I think this is an extremely dangerous situation. I go back to, if you undermine, which the EU as well as Ireland have been doing, colluding in undermining international law, which started in Gaza, and really America and Britain and indeed the EU have given the message to Trump and Netanyahu that they can do whatever they want without sanction. And now we're seeing the consequences of that. It's coming home to roost in terms of things that are very local, in terms of the price of petrol and the price of home heating oil, etc. We are reaping a whirlwind. So in that situation, I think we really do need to tilt the balance a little bit more to basically being a bit more courageous, because somebody needs to actually stand up for, even for another nothing else, it's in our own interest. What's the point having being well in with America if the world is blazing?
Okay, Marion Harkin, Minister Harkin, what do you think?
Well, I think both of my colleagues, Eimear and Pat, have articulated very clearly that Ireland faces.
Can I just say one? Sorry, Marion, just before, I think your phone might be sitting on its speaker.
That better, Greg?
It may well be, and it's just the phone might be. Yeah, so go ahead, Marion, please.
I'm holding it in my hand now, so that's how it is. But look, I think both my colleagues have articulated the complexity of this. And what I think as a small country we can do, as a small neutral country we can do, is that, and first of all, it's important to look at the actions we've taken. You spoke about Spain. We're one of the European countries, along with Spain, who recognised the state of Palestine. And can I say also that I think it'll be 2.5 years ago now since I personally was the first person to bring up in the Dáil about the EU-Israel trade agreement, because, of course, as a member of the European Parliament, I was involved in that and had voted on it. And at the time, the government did not agree with my position, but within a number of months, Ireland was one of the first governments to ask the EU to look at this trade agreement. And in my case, I was asking that it would be rescinded and that the agreement at least would be investigated. But that didn't happen at EU level, but it certainly wasn't because the countries like Ireland, Spain and other, the Netherlands, I think, the Belgians pushed for it. So for me, what Ireland does at European level is crucial. We're a small country, so we have to look and see where does our influence lie. So our influence at EU level has had some impact. I think also our influence at US level matters. And despite really difficult situations, despite other political parties saying they wouldn't go, etc., and I'm pleased to hear that they agree that the representatives of the Irish people should go, because that's what we're talking about here. It doesn't actually matter who's in government. What matters is that this is an opportunity to speak face to face with the president of the US, whoever that happens
to be. So if you happen to be on that trip to Washington, what would and you were sitting face to face with Donald Trump, Marion, what would you say to him about, if you had the opportunity, about the global affairs at the moment? What would you actually say to him if you had that audience with him? Of course, then we could move on to talk of investment and relations and best friends and all that stuff. But in that moment, what would you say to him about what's happening in Gaza, what's happening in the Middle East?
Well, sometimes, Greg, in conversations, we're asked to jump one step. You've asked me to jump about 21 steps.
Okay, no, if there's no answer, that's fine. I'm not trying. It's just in case there was something in your chest that you would like to say to him, really.
So you're asking me, to be fair, it's a reasonable question. I think that most people would want to, at some level, say the Irish people feel that what's happening at the moment is not acceptable isn't a word that's strong enough. It's against international law. And that's actually what our Minister for Foreign Affairs have said, our Taoiseach, our Tánaiste. And when an action is against international law, then we understand what that means. And I think that's a strong message. I think when you're dealing with somebody from a position, let's say that Ireland is in, to a position that the president of the US is in, I think you try and build on any connection there is, any positives there are, and try and find common ground. Because it has to be about conversation, about speaking, about defending, in this case, the international rules. And I think that's what Ireland just has to do. And if I was there, that's what I would try and do. But to be honest with you, Greg, it's not a job I think most of us, any of us, would want. It's difficult. It's about negotiating in the most difficult of circumstances. But we know that conflicts and that are only ever resolved when we negotiate in the most difficult of circumstances. Mm. So we couldn't stand back. And if I was in Micheál Martin's position, then that's what I would have to do.
Just in relation to Professor O'Connor's concerns that this could become into some sort of a global conflict and our place in Europe, and I suppose our place as a neutral country. I remember speaking to you some time in the past, Marion, and you were very much, I think, and I don't want to misquote you and you correct me, in favour of the triple lock. But just looking at some of your comments since, I wonder, are you as a bigger fan of the triple lock as you once were?
Well, I remember that time. It was one of the we had a vote about was it Nice or Lisbon? I think it was Nice at the time. Correct me if I think it was Nice, about the triple lock. And at that time, Ireland had rejected the Nice Treaty, and this was about all of the new countries joining the EU. And the triple lock was that the government, the Dáil, and the EU, sorry, the UN, would have the final say on Ireland's participation in peacekeeping. Now, that word cannot be underlined sufficiently enough. Peacekeeping. That's what it was about. And at the time, that's what people wanted. maybe it's still what they want, but they certainly wanted that assurance, because there was a lot of talk about EU armies, about Irish young Irish men and women being conscripted, etc. And people were asked to vote on that, and they did. In recent times, the Taoiseach has brought forward the idea that the triple lock, in fact, rather than giving Ireland the opportunity to act independently, and that's what we're talking about in the conversation now, about going to meet Donald Trump and giving the Irish perspective. So rather than Ireland acting independently, that our participation in peacekeeping would be determined not by the Irish people, not by the Dáil, but by members of the UN, for example, the UK, Russia, the US. And sometimes in life, Greg, as in politics, things move on and you have to look at something in a new light, in a new context. Things don't always remain as they are. For me, neutrality is a core value. It is something I am absolutely...
But that is why, too, though, the triple lock is seen as that ultimate anchor for our neutrality, our military neutrality, by the way. And that UN mandate requires that we only participate in missions that have broad international legitimacy. We don't want to be joining, do we, coalitions of the willing or missions led by military alliances like NATO. And that's the triple lock anchors us away from that, does it not?
Yeah, you're absolutely right about all of that. But the problem is that when the UN was working, when international law meant something, when we could rely on the UN to support peacekeeping in places where peacekeeping was needed, then of course it was something that the Irish people could rely on. But that has changed. You know that, I've known that. So it's certainly a discussion we need to have and to see what the impact for Ireland is in, I won't say a new world order, but a changed world order.
Okay, Niamh, just Niamh or Pat, do either of you want to come in on that just before we take a break and move on? Pat?
I suppose just to say, I think the problem is the UN needs to be reformed, and I'd far rather the government be actually tackling that issue than basically fiddling around with the issue of the triple lock.
Niamh?
Yeah, absolutely, I agree. I just wanted to, I suppose, emphasise the importance of the triple lock and how we can stand firmly with Ukraine and also defend international law without abandoning our military neutrality.
On the St. Patrick's Day trip, Micheál Martin, says a listener, seems to have forgotten conveniently the rebuke he got from the White House last year. Trump has no interest in Ireland, however, midterms on the way, and is trying to shore up the Irish-American vote. Shame on our government. Well, listen, maybe both parties, there's a bit of something in it for them. Where were all these politicians advocating for human rights when the Iranian Islamic regime were persecuting and murdering innocent women and girls for years and decades? Political grandstanding. Well, no one's here. I've heard no one come out here to bat for Iran. Greg, the Taoiseach should go to America and meet all the businesses. He should make a point of not going to the White House, among other things. Israel's now bombing Lebanon and we've troops there. He could make a great statement but not attending the White House, but he will be there nodding away beside Trump. But, I mean, if you have that view, you also have to be accepting the consequences or the potential consequences of that. Surely the correct choice of words for this illegal war is undocumented. Greg, you can trace all the issues in the Middle East back to our near neighbours across the sea and the USA. It might have something to do with oil. As someone once said, America is very lucky because every time they liberate a country, they discover oil. I remember oil and being a motivator for war used to be like this big secret, and now it's just everyone knows. That's often one of the key reasons for it. This is a story we talked about before, of course. It's an ongoing issue that's affecting those affected by the Chrysler tragedy, particularly the families of the victims. We've heard from the president and we've heard from Sinn Féin leader Mary Lou McDonald. She met with families of the Chrysler tragedy victims, backing their calls for a full public inquiry and a meeting with the Justice Minister. Marion Harkin, you'd obviously be very familiar with this story. Do you support the Chrysler families? in their call for a public inquiry, and also to a sit down with Jim O'Callaghan, just to find out, I suppose, the state of play. Not necessarily for him to give a cast iron commitment to that inquiry. They just want to meet with him.
Well, first of all, can I say that yes, I'm on more than one occasion.
Marion, it's very important that I hear what you have to say, and it's not your fault, and I'm so sorry. Even if you turn it to landscape, it would be fine so that your hands are free. Yeah, perfect. Thank you so much, Marion.
Yeah, thank you, Greg. It's just apologies the way I was putting my phone
It's
there.
Okay.
And to you and to your listeners, because they need to hear what's going on also. First of all, yes, of course, I'm very familiar with Taoiseach and have been there many times. And I think what all of us want to see is justice for those families. Because what happened was, I think, was just beyond shocking. It was just unthinkable that something like this would happen, but it did. And I think when that happens to you and your family, then all you want is that there is some kind of closure, some kind of resolution, some kind of answer. Now, it's my understanding, I may be wrong here, but that Minister Jim O'Callaghan did meet with one of the families previously before Christmas, I think, in December, to hear their concerns. And I think what the minister said is that the Garda investigation will determine exactly what happened at Krishla. He has said that he has spoken to the commissioner and that the resources in place are sufficient for the Gardaí to do what they need to do. And he said that that's the most appropriate process to understand exactly what has happened. So a file has been sent to the Director of Public Prosecutions, the DPP, and we are awaiting a response from the DPP. And I think a quote from the Minister, I read, and it's accurate, but I certainly read it, where he said, there needs to be, and I hope there will be, criminal prosecution in respect of what happened at Krishla. And he said that for him, that will be justice for the families. Look, none of us, under any circumstances, would want to find ourselves in the position that those families are in. And what we, I think, in government have to try and ensure is that there is full investigation of the circumstances, full understanding of what happened, and then that the Gardaí and the DPP decide to either instigate criminal prosecutions or other
And that will have to take its course, but that will not answer certain questions, and that's where we might get a the benefit of the public inquiry, not just to answer questions, but also to perhaps to prevent similar instances in the future. What lessons can be learned? What you know, for an example, co-location of different types of be it, you know, business and residential or whatever it might be. You know, yes, it'll be very interesting to see the outcome of the criminal investigation, whether anything comes from that. But what the families want, and other parties seem to be of the view, that a full public inquiry, the like that we've seen people affected by other great tragedies around this island campaign for decades to get. You know, why can't we in the present now, alongside the criminal investigation, have a full public inquiry, Marion, to see what lessons can be learned, what mistakes were made, what legislation wasn't followed or was followed or whatever it might be?
Well, according to the Minister, what he wants to see is that we get to the point that the DPP make their decision, the Gardaí finish their inquiry, and then we decide where to move. Look, I know for the families involved, this is, I won't even say what it is, because I couldn't possibly experience, so I won't say anything. But what I can say is that I think what the minister is really interested in is that there is justice for the family, for the community, and that the first part of that process, and it's not a short process, it's a long process, will be that we finish this part of it, that the DPP and the Gardaí include what they're doing, and when that's finished, then we move on, perhaps in parallel, perhaps subsequent, I'm not sure how they will do it, whatever investigations.
Your parallel would be all the families are looking for. That is what they're looking for. They want the why should this very drawn out criminal process, why should that have to conclude? I'm not asking you, this is what they're saying. Why should that have to conclude before a full public inquiry? Niamh McGuinness, what's your view?
I don't understand, Greg. I think I'd be in the same position as a lot of people listening here this morning, that a public inquiry and a criminal process, they're not mutually exclusive. And if both are handled correctly, I don't understand why they can't run in tandem. The families are very aware and very understanding that a criminal process will take a long time. And I think it's the minister's job, and to reflect back on his words earlier in the week, that it's not his job to be sensitive regarding this issue. I think that it is. And I do think that there is things that the minister could do to offer support to these families. For example, you know, Mr. McEntee, when she was in position, had promised the families a liaison. That didn't materialise. It's an example of something that Minister O'Callaghan can do and won't. You know, there are questions that the criminal investigation absolutely alone, that's all that it can answer. But a public inquiry and working with the minister, it can aid the process.
I think what people also struggle with, Niamh, not just those that are directly affected by this, but watching on, is that history has told us what happens when an awful lot of time passes in terms of public inquiries or what have you, that, you know, families have to go generations, and people die before there's a resolution. Mm-hmm. And here we are living in the present, and they're going, well, we can avoid making those mistakes of the past and allow people to get over this part of that journey, be it criminal or be it a public inquiry. And I think really it's not been clearly articulated to anybody as to why we're not doing that like we hadn't in the past.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you're can right. I put that directly to you as well, Marion, just before I bring Pat in, just that proposal that I put to Niamh there?
Just clarify that again for me.
Well, what we don't have is information. We don't have it. You've said maybe it's parallel, maybe it's subsequent. Like, we should have learned from the past, surely, that we don't want families having to spend the rest of their lives not only dealing with this tragedy, but also campaigning for answers by way of a public inquiry and a clear timeline or clear messaging or that liaison that Ms. McEntee promised. You know, that would go so far to easing people's hardship in the interim.
No, to be honest, I hear what you're saying. I wasn't aware that a liaison was promised, not delivered. I can't comment on that. It's the first time I've heard about it. But I do know what Minister O'Callaghan has said, that he wants this part of the process. And while I can't put a timeline on it, my sense is that it's well underway and maybe... No, I won't even say that because I'm only surmising.
Yeah, well, we do know, if this helps, we do know some information has been passed on to the DPP and a file is due, a second file is due to go to the DPP. Yeah. That is
but
in the public domain.
Another couple of months, or it can take longer. We know that it entirely depends on the circumstances, and that's why I don't want to put any sort of...
But in your heart, would you represent, because, you know, of course you do represent part of the Donegal, would you represent to Minister O'Callaghan, having an understanding of the heartache here, you know, for better information, or at least a meeting to outline in more clear terms with families more broadly as to why we must defer a public inquiry?
Well, it's my understanding he had a meeting
with one
of the families. And to be fair, I think that that's a reasonable step for him to take. Whether there could be another meeting that perhaps might help, and I will leave that to the Donegal TDs and ministers to see what can be managed. But the point is that there's a process happening. It's a legal process. Mm. And I think when that's completed, and we would all hope it will be completed in the reasonable near future, that then we can decide prosecutions, that will depend on the outcome, but also about a public inquiry.
Okay, thank you, Minister. I want to bring Pat O'Connor. We're running out of time. I do want to bring Pat O'Connor in, but I appreciate your contribution so much.
I find it hard to understand why the minister is taking such a strangely unempathic line. I mean, in a way, the Haulage Association meets ministers, all sorts of people meet ministers, no problem. And yet in this case, I mean, he's digging in his heels. Why is the question in my mind? I think the call for a public inquiry is actually very useful also to really encourage, in inverted commas, the DPP to move a little quicker. I suppose I'm in a position where I only know what I read in the newspapers, and I feel I'm missing some vital element. But it's almost as if the government has learned nothing from past experiences. But it's also so unusual to have a senior minister who arguably wants to be Taoiseach sort of saying he's not interested in being sensitive. I feel I'm, you know, there's some elephant.
Well,
he says it's
not his job to be sensitive, but he did go on to say it's his job to find out answers and to move the process along. And maybe it wasn't a fantastic choice of words, but it wouldn't be necessarily fair to take them completely out of the context of this old comment. Marion?
Can I just make a quick comment there? Look, I didn't actually hear Minister O'Callaghan's comments, but I know from working with him, dealing with him, he is sensitive to these matters, but he's also the Minister for Justice. And he has a responsibility to ensure that justice is served. Okay. Now, all of us in politics know that politics is about people. It's not just process. It's not just outcomes, not just what happens. And I think the minister has very clearly said that he is hugely empathic here, but he has a job to do and a role to do. And he has ruled nothing out. He has met some of the families, one of the families, and he is very much engaged in all of this.
Okay.
Trying to manage it, I think, and can't speak for him, in the best way possible that we'll get the best outcome for the families.
Okay, Minister Marion Hawkins, thank you for your time. Have a wonderful weekend. Professor Pat O'Connor, lovely to see you as always. Thanks for your time. It's been great thank having you. You on. And Niamh, this is your first time with us on the Friday panel?
It is, yeah. Thank you for having me.
You will come back?
Of course.
Happy days. Chat to you soon. Have a great weekend. Okay.
The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio. Text, WhatsApp, 086 60 25000. Call 074 91 25000 or email comments at highlandradio.com.
Now, before we get to your comments, delighted to welcome into studio Corinne Temple from our digital team. Good morning to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning, Greg.
And you come bearing gifts as well, because yes, as listeners will know, the Highland Radio's home makeover draw in association with Foy's, it's ongoing, and we've got €10,000 for home makeover, €10,000 in cash, and the draw's just around the corner as well at the start of April. But there's more, and that's why you're in here. So what are you bringing into us?
Exactly. So we are now launching a grand a day giveaway as part of the draw as well. So from Monday the 23rd to Friday the 27th, every day that week, we're going to give €1,000 away on a different show. So if you already have your ticket for the draw, you're already automatically entered into all of those draws. But if you haven't got your ticket, now's the time to get it.
Now, you've been out, and we'll talk more about that. You've been out at Foy's, of course, €10,000. I think we could all do with that to spruce up the house. It would go an awful long way. You could actually go completely to town on one room, or I think you could do quite a bit with a few rooms.
Oh, you definitely could. And then with the 10,000 cash along with it, like, you could definitely make a good difference in the home. And Foy's have some gorgeous stuff down there as well. So,
yeah, I might spend the 10K in Foy's, the 10,000 in cash. Might get a robot lawnmower maybe, or go on holidays. I don't know.
Yeah, okay, you bought robot mower would be handy too, wouldn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I think so. But I wonder, are they any good? But that's besides the point. Right, so the tickets are €15 for one. Very popular, though, is the tenner a ticket, really. And if you buy five, you get them for €10.
Exactly, each. That's a great deal. You get the five for 50. And it's live now, again, on our website, highlandradio.com. And then also, like, Mother's Day is on Sunday. So it's a great wee gift. So you could buy a ticket, print it, stick it in the card, and then she has the chance of winning the full prize or a grand a day.
Exactly. And the prize reminds me a little bit of those people give the millionaire raffle tickets.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, same idea.
So you get it on, you know, Christmas Day and the mm-hmm. draw is not till the new year. It doesn't matter. You've got the gift and it's there in the bank. So it still is a fantastic prize for Mother's Day. So 15 for one ticket, €50 for five. So that's €10 a ticket. And you can buy the tickets online. It's perfectly safe, perfectly secure. Highlandradio.com. Or you can give us a call here at the radio station.
Give us a call here, yeah. If you're not tech savvy, give us a wee call and we can put the ticket three fee online as well.
And also, if you're one of the Cash is King crew, you can call up here during office hours at the Mountaintop in Letterkenny and we will sort you out there as well. So it's a simple one really, Corinne, isn't it? If you want to be in all of the draws, it's six draws in total.
Six
you have
draws
to get
in total.
Yep. Before...
Get your tickets before Monday the 23rd.
Okay,
so you've all weekend week, now and all next week
okay,
to get your tickets in. Yeah.
All right, and as you say, if you've already bought your tickets, you're in anyway.
You're in. So if you want to buy another one to give yourself another wee chance, you can.
So just to remind you, from Monday the 23rd of March to Friday the 27th of March, we're giving away €1,000 every single day. It's our Grand A Day giveaway, and it's across all of the shows. And just to remind you, if your ticket's drawn out, we might try and give you a call just to have a chat with you for the crack, but you don't have to come on the radio. You don't have to answer in a certain amount of rings. Your ticket is your prize. Your ticket comes out. You have won. And your ticket, if you win 1,000, can go back into the draw drum. And I used to joke about someone winning.
It has happened.
Like, I used to say, that's never going to happen.
That's never going to happen.
And
it's happened.
It did.
Within
happen,
a week? Was it within a week or 2 weeks?
Yeah, it was crazy. Yeah, it was in the last one.
€2,000. Yeah.
And that is really random because the only thing is, Corinne, and I've said this before on the show, and this is casting no shade on any other draws, there can be draws like this, and they're across Britain and Ireland, mm-hmm. you know, and hundreds of thousands of people enter them, right?
Yep.
And as I say, that's fine, not trying to put shade on anyone, and that's grand. But this is not on that scale. So, you know, your odds
you
are fantastic.
You have a much better chance to win,
And I've compared it to Lotto odds on a very small prize before. Nothing's guaranteed, it's still an open draw, but trust... I think every single winner that we've ever had has been from Donegal.
Yeah, they're all local.
I can't recall anyone from... So that's it's your draw. It is for you. And it's of a size whereby you've a greater chance mm-hmm. of winning. And 1,000 a day, that would be nice.
It'll be lovely.
Do you have any idea where you'd spend the €10,000? Your house is probably like a new pin, is it, anyway?
Well, there's still bits. There's still wee finishing touches. So, like, if I could enter, this would just... finish it off for me.
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
Do you know stuff that I'm like, God, I really need to get curtains for there. Yes. I really need to get something
But do you
there.
Know what the €10,000 home makeover money is good for? It's not for need, it's for want.
That's it,
right? Because
exactly.
what we have to do nowadays, most of us, is we get what we need. Mm-hmm. With that €10,000, you get what you want.
You get the stuff that you right? want. And then also like... The girls and foys are amazing as well because you might look at a room and go, I have no idea where to start or what to do with this. Mm. Whereas they will help with that as well as part of the prize.
Yeah, because I mean, picking a paint colour is difficult.
It is.
If you know, if you've got a couch, do you pick it for the couch or mm-hmm. the couch is a movable feast? The paint is too. But what do you do with curtains? What do you do with cushions?
Yeah. If you don't know where to start, they're really, really good for helping you out there as well.
Fantastic. And it's great to be working again with foys. So €10,000 to spend with that company, which is fantastic, and also €10,000 in cash, which you can add to the home renovation pot if you like, or spend it on whatever you like. And if you buy your tickets over the next few days, you are entered into an additional five draws for €1,000. Maybe you think lower numbers are lucky, get in early, maybe like mid numbers, it's up to you, whatever you want to do. €15 for one ticket, five for 50. And just remind us once again, Corinne, how people get hold of their tickets.
Yeah, so highlandradio.com, there's a wee home makeover draw tab there on the website. So if you go on there, click that, select your ticket and put in your details. But again, you can give us a call here or you can call in if you have problems with that.
Yeah, 07491 25000, our team will help you out there. And I'll tell you what will happen is we will get a rush either on the Monday morning. Which show is it first on Monday?
Yourself.
Myself, right. Yeah. So there'll probably be something of a rush in advance of that draw or over the weekend ahead of it. Get it out of the way now. Get your ticket, put it in the somewhere safe, and it's yours then. We email you the tickets out. Just to remind you, you don't have to answer within a certain amount of rings. You don't have to answer a phone call. If your ticket comes out, it's associated with you, and you win. 07491 25000. Call us or go to highlandradio.com. And the first €1,000 will be drawn a week on Monday.
Yes.
Thank you so much for
Lovely.
Calling in.
Thank
Corinne,
you.
Look after
Thank
yourself.
You.
Now, if you were listening to the show yesterday or you have listened to this week's Greg Hughes podcast, you would have heard from Louise James. Now, Louise very sadly lost five members of her family in the Buncrana Pier tragedy, it has come to be known, the anniversary of which is next Friday. Whilst it, as far as I can determine, wasn't found to be a contributing factor, the condition of the pier did come up in evidence during the inquest. It wasn't gated, and there were claims that there were algae, or there was algae on it, and it was slippy. And it is, by coincidence, also being discussed, pier safety, by Joanna McNulty, who very sadly lost Joachi McNulty when his car slipped on algae at Balderic Pier in County Mayo. Joanna, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us today. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you.
Tell us about what happened to your father.
Yeah, so Dad's name is actually pronounced Joachim.
I beg your pardon. But... Sorry, Joanna, my fault.
No worries, no worries. On the 18th of February, Dad went down to the pier, as he does every single evening, to meet up with the locals. They go down for an hour or two to chat, all things farming, fishing, weather, football, whatever. So that happened around 4:30, 4:45 that evening. And on that evening, myself and my partner and my daughter were at my in-laws, and around 8:05, my mum rang me. And she said, Joanna, there's something wrong with your dad. He said he's after calling me. He's in difficulty down at the pier. And he wants you to come and help him. He said he hasn't much time left. So we raced over from Aaron's parents' house to the pier. We got there in about 10 minutes, but unfortunately when we got there, his car was completely submerged in the water.
So was he, did he make a call from the car as it entered the water, Joanna?
Yeah, so I presume the car was in the water by the time he rang, but that the water hadn't either had partly started entering the car or hadn't fully entered the car, but he knew he had only minutes left.
And he struggled to try and escape the vehicle as well, and evidence of that was found on his body.
Yeah, so that happened Wednesday evening, and we didn't get his body back until Friday, but when we seen his arm on the Friday, it was completely black and blue, bruised from trying to get out of the car.
I'm so sorry that this happened to Joachim, but also that you're having to go through this as well. It's incredibly, incredibly sad. And I mean, he managed to speak to your mum, but it just is unbelievable too, because it gives you an insight into where he was at in those moments. Joachim too was an experienced seafarer. He was familiar with the sea. He was a fisherman. That was a spot he regularly went. You know, this, he wasn't someone from a city that just happened there and this befell him. He knew what was what, but still fell victim.
Yeah, and that's partly why I'm trying to raise so much awareness about this, because if it can happen to someone like Dad, who knew as much about the sea as he did, then it can happen to anyone. But I guess one thing that I want to raise, and which I've raised over the last few days, is that there was this brownish, reddish algae or moss, I'm not sure what the correct term for it is, that was at the top of the pier. And we spent 4 hours on the pier that night waiting for Dad's body to come in. We walked over and back at the top of the slipway, and we couldn't see it. And it wasn't until the next day when we went down to lay flowers at the pier that we'd seen it. And that is lethally, lethally slipping once it gets wet. So if we couldn't see it walking over and back, there's very little chance for anyone who's in a car in the dark to be able to see it.
Yeah, indeed. And the whole situation was exacerbated by a delay in getting your dad out of the water as well. That took hours. Was that complicated by sea conditions or?
Yeah, so everything was kind of against him on the night. So at the time that his car entered the water, it was nearly fully high tide. And then there was really heavy swell as well that evening. So the emergency services couldn't actually enter the water, like the divers couldn't enter the water until the tide had gone out and it was safe for them to do so. And it was only really the divers who could attach the ropes or whatever to the car to secure the car to be able to winch it in.
And there were warning signs, weren't they? Because other fishermen, local fishermen, had noticed the pier was, or the slip, sorry, was particularly slippy in the weeks leading up to this tragedy, but also to the emergency services, the divers, I presume, those on scene, also noted that the slip was very slippy.
Yeah, it was hard enough watching the scene unfolding that night, but when the divers went down the pier to try and winch up the car, they were slipping all over the place, and you were sitting there just wondering, oh my God, is somebody else going to lose their life while they're trying to recover dead thrust? Like, you know, that fear was... But it's been noted to the relevant authorities several times last year that the slipway is incredibly mossy. And it's not just the pier in Balderic. Since I posted my account of what happened and my call for more safety measures around piers on Facebook last Sunday, people from all around the country have contacted me to say, actually, our local pier is just as bad. It's covered in moss and algae. We've reported it to the local authorities. Nobody is getting back to us. They're telling us they don't have the budget to do it, or it's not a priority, and it's just not getting done.
What do you think, and you know, you're using this as an opportunity to highlight your concerns, and there's engineers and other people probably very qualified to figure out what to do with this, but what would seem to be a logical thing is each local authority, regular audits or some sort of a contact detail close to a slip. If those local people, they can be the voice, they can be the eyes and the ears potentially, you know, some... Because I presume it, you spray it. I imagine what that is one of the ways you might deal with it. But some sort of a audit or ongoing review or whatever. I mean, it can't be beyond our means to do that. Is that what you think might work best, Joanna?
Yeah. So in my eyes, there needs to be a regular safety review done at the piers. Like immediately, there needs to be one overall review done, like in terms of lighting, signage, things like that, that can be done straight away. But in terms of the regular ongoing maintenance, there needs to be a check every few weeks to see how quickly the algae and moss is going back and whether it poses a risk. And then there needs to be safety barriers on all the piers as well, because, you know, the county council or whoever the relevant authority is to come out and clean the pier, they may not get to it. Once it's reported, it may take a week or two. And so there needs to be barriers put in place that protect the public from the risk until the authorities get out to clean it.
Yeah, okay. Listen, I'm so sorry for everything that you're going through. And now you wait for an inquest. Have you been given any indication as to when that inquest might happen?
No, we have no idea. It'll be a good few months at the very earliest.
All right. Well, listen, we wish you all the strength you need at this most difficult time. Thank you very much for coming on with us. And I'm sure there's many people listening to you that will agree, but I know everyone listening to you is sending their love and sympathy to you and their strength. Thank you for your time, Joanna.
Thank you. Bye-bye. All
right, look after yourself. Bye-bye. That is Joanna McNulty, daughter of Joachim, who very sadly passed away just back in February. He lost his life when the car he was driving or in slipped on algae at Balderic Pier in Cantamio. That will be examined, I presume, as part of that inquest. Very difficult. The loss in and of itself, the circumstances of the loss, but the fact that they have learned that, they know that Joachim was able to make a call to his wife Geraldine, and Geraldine was able to say to Joanna, your dad's in difficulty, he doesn't have time left. So we can only imagine what that call must have been like, learning that he did fight to save. He had applied the handbrake. He did fight to save his life, his arm bruised as he tried to smash the window to exit. And, of course, now the search for answers and the search for the campaign for measures to be put in place that something like this cannot happen again. There'll always be instances when water is involved. It's a dangerous space, someone falling from a pier, between a pier and a boat or whatever it might be. But what we, the only thing we can do is, you can't avoid everything, is to make sure that we do everything to best limit such a thing happening. Okay, 0866 60 25,000 is the WhatsApp and text number. 0866 60 25,000. Staying, or should I say moving to the roads, I'm told there's a crash between Lahey and Ballantra. I'm not sure the extent of that. I hope everyone is okay. But I'm told that there may be delays. So approach that area. Many of you travelling down that direction or up from that direction all of the time, approach with caution just until such time as they have that cleared. Now, just a note for your diary. Next Friday, the 20th of March, there is a quiz night in the Carrickart Hotel. It's in aid of the Meva Community First Responders, another group of great individuals that are on hand just as the community might need them. So that's a quiz night from 9 p.m. next Friday in the Carrickart Hotel. €10 per person, a maximum of 5 people per team, and there'll be prizes on the night as well. And as I mentioned, it's in aid of Meva First Responders. There's live music with the Henry Girls at McGrory's Hotel in Coldaff. It is tonight between 8.30 and 10.30 p.m. Tonight's the 13th, it is, isn't it? Tickets are €25 plus a booking fee. You can have tickets plus dinner for €59. Not too bad at all. That's the Henry Girls, who are performing live at McGrory's Hotel Coldaff from 8.30 tonight. That would be a lovely night, I would say. Right, the last Cahirlock of the Inishowen Municipal District is Councillor Fionnán Bradley. He joins me now. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Greg, and good morning to all your listeners.
Right, we were talking about the Buncrana Community Hospital and another delay to it. And I suppose, too, even if it gets over the line, the sense that really, you know, it's not going to add any extra beds than were there before, and it's not really going to meet the demand we know that will be there. But listen, we are where we're at, and there is a protest taking place, and it is coming up tomorrow. Is that right? Tell us about it.
Yes, that's correct, Craig, and thank you for an opportunity to come on this morning and to talk to you about the issue and to promote the protest. So the Inish Theatre Group took the initiative yesterday as a community-based organisation following the announcement that there has been another further completely unacceptable delay to the project to organise a protest. And they're asking everybody to gather at the nursing unit outside it at 4 p.m. tomorrow afternoon. Everybody's very welcome. You don't have to have a member of your family in the unit currently or anything like that, because the nursing unit, or the community hospital as it's known now, has touched everybody's lives in the wider Buncrana area in some way or other. We've all had a relative or a friend or a neighbour who has been in the unit or who has a member of staff in it or whatever. So everybody in the wider Buncrana area has a connection to our nursing unit. And it's vitally important that we will get a massive turnout tomorrow to send solidarity to the families of those who have people living in it now, and also to those who are waiting to get respite and step-down care and when the workers are finished.
I think what it does too is it gives the community, I mean, we're here and what have you, but this gives the people an opportunity to come together and express their voice as a unit. And with that in mind, the greater the turnout, the bigger the message that is sent. Because as you say, you might not necessarily have a connection to it right now, but I guarantee you everyone in the region, either directly or indirectly, has a connection to this facility and should have a say in expediting, if that's the word, getting it over the line, really, getting it up and running as quick as possible.
Indeed. And I mean, to that end, Greg, almost immediately after the protest was organised yesterday, I was liaising with my colleagues in the Inish Theatre Group. And as soon as it was organised, I had sent a formal invitation to Dermot Monaghan, who's the IHA manager for the Donegal region, and who ultimately has responsibility for this project, to come to the protest. And I assured him that it's not in any way to lambast him or anything, but just come, see the volume of people who turn out, see the type of people, listen to the families who have people in the unit, and far more importantly, listen to the families of those who have loved ones in other places in the county who cannot get into the community hospital in Buncrana and who are far away from their support base, their family circle, their friends.
And Fionn, and obviously, you know, you have a minister who's a party colleague of yours within spitting distance of this hospital. What's he saying about these delays, and what's he going to do to make representations to the Minister for Health, who I presume we could hope would put pressure on the HSE?
Absolutely. And up until this point, I might mention what myself and Minister McConnell have done. We have sent countless pieces of correspondence to the HSE and indeed to the Minister looking for this project to be expedited. And yesterday morning, we sought an urgent meeting with Stair McMonaghan and senior HSE officials in this region, quite honestly, to get some clarity on exactly where the project is at, because I'm confused personally now as to what stage of the process we're at. And one piece of correspondence back in November, they had stated to us that the project was due to go to construction in quarter one of 26. And then the correspondence we received yesterday morning informed us that we're now at stage one of pre-tender approval. So there is absolutely no clarity, Greg, quite honestly, about exactly what the project is
at. Quite the opposite of in fact.
I want to assure the community. Absolutely.
Okay,
I want to assure the community that myself and Minister McConnell are doing, and will be doing absolutely everything, because this is totally unacceptable.
Okay.
And Minister McConnell, I must thank him for the €1.4 million that he managed to secure in the HSE capital plan for the works to progress. So this is not a funding issue. This is completely and totally down to HSE management or mismanagement, because the money is there, the funding is there, the work could start tomorrow, the work could start today, or it could have started yesterday. This is simply a case for HSE mismanagement.
You'll be at the protest, is Minister McConnell attending?
Yes, I will be at the protest. No, unfortunately, Minister McConnell is overseas with St Patrick's Day.
Oh, he's in Thailand, that's right. I forgot about that. Okay.
He left the country just yesterday, but I'll be there representing the Fianna Fáil party.
Okay, community protest for Buncrana Community Hospital tomorrow, 4 p.m. Buncrana Nursing Unit. Thank you for your time. That is the Leas Cathaoir Lough of the Inishowen Municipal District Councillor Fionn Bradley speaking there. On the issue of traffic, what a ridiculous idea to create a town team and suggest staggered opening hours for business. Yes, I had a brief look at this. Does this mean the Bonagie Bridge is once again on the long finger? Sort out our roads and never mind asking already struggling businesses to take a hit on opening times. I presume it's the big employees that maybe if they staggered, you know, 8, 9, half 9, half 8 or something. It's something to look at. I wouldn't necessarily, you know, disregard it out of hand. Let's see, maybe there's something to it. I must read up a little bit more about that. Michelle Boner joins me on the programme now, whose daughter is in Qatar near Doha and very near where missiles are landing. I can only imagine what it's like, Michelle, because really, because of the good morning to you firstly, but because of how strictly the governments over there are controlling information, we're not really, I don't think, getting a full sense of what it's like for our families, our loved ones living out there. So what are you hearing?
Well, they are all, you know, they are all terrified, to be honest. And they're in high-rise buildings, predominantly a lot of, you know, people who move over from Ireland are living in, you know, transient apartments, which were made out of hotels, and they still operate as a hotel, you know, during the World Cup. And you know, they're not very resilient buildings, should I say?
Mm-hmm.
And they're high rise. My daughter's living on the 40th floor of a building, so they're, you know, target wise, they're very large, you know, buildings and could be hit, you know, at any time. And everybody has to stay in their apartment since all of this commenced. So there is no going out. There's no walking about because the government over there are trying to protect the citizens that are living there and the visiting citizens that are living there by telling them, you know, to just remain indoors. So, you know, it's like a lockdown situation for them at the moment.
And your daughter has
they've
made...
They've all registered.
With the Department of Foreign Affairs, I presume. Your daughter has made the decision to quit her job and come home. That really is quite telling. That's a big, big decision. Can you give us a bit of a background?
It is a big decision. Well, you know, it's simply the fear and the ongoing escalation of the war. It's apparent to them that you know, it's racking up, shall we say. And, you know, there's more activity in different locations in the Middle East as a result of that. There are a number of American bases around where people are living, and they will continue to be targeted. Because obviously, you know, if you take out an American base, it means that the Americans cannot, do their activities in relation to this sudden and ridiculous and unexpected war that they've started over there. So everybody from all parts that are living in the likes of Doha, Qatar, you know, Dubai, all of those Irish citizens are sitting there. They've registered with the Department of Foreign Affairs. Not one person has had an email from the Department of Foreign Affairs to say, this is our plan. You know, there's so much, you know, it's like watching a pope getting elected. There's so much white smoke.
But if you watch the social media, you'd get the impression that Minister Helen McEntee and her office is working to get people home who want to come home. And we're seeing other countries actually doing that. But the sense is that the Irish state is not doing enough or not working enough quickly to get people home and out of the danger that is there.
I can tell you now they are doing absolutely nothing. One flight went into Oman, which I believe was already a scheduled flight. Nobody has been in contact from the Department of Foreign Affairs asking people, would you like to go home? You know, here's our plan. There is no such thing in operation as a complete spin that's going on. My daughter has booked several flights herself, and they have subsequently been cancelled due to, you know, activity at the airport or, a missile hit something. So then the flights are cancelled and do not take off. They have spent all their own money booking flights, and then you don't get the money back for 28 days. So, like, how does our government expect that people who are trying to get out of the country will actually manage to get out if they're constantly having to book flights, wait for 28 days for the money to come back? So therefore they're booking another flight on their credit card. And it's a vicious circle of booking flights, waiting, will you get the money back in 28 days? And you know, they're constantly booking flights and they're getting cancelled. So, like, they have no way out.
Okay.
Some people have gone to enormous lengths to go to other countries.
Spent an awful lot
of
money, too.
So, for example, they leave Doha, get a taxi, and go to Dubai and get a flight out. Do you think the Department of Foreign Affairs is going to give our citizens, you know, who have tax-paying parents in this country, you know, are they going to give them any money back for having had to do that?
Okay,
because
Department
of Foreign Affairs,
we're going to make contact with the Department of Foreign Affairs to see what they plan on doing. I have observed myself that they potentially could be doing more. Michelle, just finally, is your daughter an outlier? There are tens of thousands of Irish over in the Middle East. I presume she's part of a wider Irish community. Is she on her own in seeking to get home, or other people working over there looking to get home as well?
No, lots of people this week in particular have found other ways out and have used the mechanisms to get out, like to get a taxi for 7 or 8 hours to go to another airport, you know, to try and get out of the country, because everybody's worried about the escalation and the continuing bombing that's going on. Yeah. And, you can't even get out by water because, those straits are closed. Yeah. So, Ireland, has accommodated many migrants in recent years, and, we cannot accommodate our own citizens, our Irish-born citizens to get out of another country.
Okay. Leave it with us, Michelle.
It's an absolute joke because of not doing, if you know what I'm saying.
Because of the risk of 2 years imprisonment, we're not getting information really anymore from Dubai, Bahrain, Qatar, UAE, and, independent sources are pointing to a lot of high-rise buildings, quite a number of them being hit in that region. Michelle, leave it with us. We'll get in contact. If anyone has any insight into that, please let us know. So I'm joined in our studio here at the Mountaintop in Letterkenny by Seamus Gordon and his sister Margaret Gordon. Both of you, thank you so very much for joining us.
Thank you, Greg.
And this is a lovely story because you two have come together to create a documentary about your father, Benny Gordon, his life, and it's called Great. Seamus, I'll start with you. Where did this idea come from? Because I think sometimes lots of us have notions of things, but we never make it happen.
Yes. Thanks very much, Greg, for having us. It came about, our mum died in 2018, and after her death, we were supporting Dad, and he would talk a lot about his life and their relationship, about Mary and about raising the family and everything. So as he talked, I would write just to try and keep the to keep the memory.
Your own archive.
Yes,
really.
Yes. And then one evening he came in and he said, you know, somebody should write this down. And I says to him, I'm not so sure about writing it down, but how about filming you and you talking and telling us these stories? And he said yes, he was up for it, and that we kicked off from there.
And Margaret, your father, a very interesting man, lots of contributions in life, lots of different jobs, and a fascinating insight, I think, into our past here.
Yeah.
So it's great that that's not being lost.
No. I remember when we were younger, my father used to start to tell us stories and we would roll our eyes. It was like he was never a child. You know, he didn't have friends. And I suppose during the making of this film now, and we've seen old photographs of him with people, and it's kind of dawned on us, you know, that he had a life very much like ours and he grew up with people. So it was lovely for us to be able to do these recordings. They actually took maybe about 4 or 5 years altogether because we were interrupted with COVID. And I suppose in the film as well, you can see the aging process, you know.
And he's 100. He still lives at home.
Yeah, yeah.
He does.
And how's he getting on?
Very well, like for being 100 and more and pushing 101. He does very well. He has the support of his family around him, support of excellent neighbours on either side. So he's doing well. He's keeping well.
And he worked in the rural electricity scheme. He was a home assistance officer with the North Western Health Board, a rent collector with the council. He played trombone and was a film projectionist.
Sometimes
so what are you going to talk to him about?
Well, you know, they had 10 kids. So
how in God's name did you fit time into 10 kids? I'm not a biology teacher, but my word.
Yeah. I suppose he had two jobs most of the time.
I'd say so, right.
At least. Yeah.
And he had a really good work ethic.
Yeah.
It would have come from his mother. His father died when Benny was 11. And he was the youngest in the family, so he was left with her and she would have kept a tight rein on him. And at that time in 1940, the vocational school in Stranorder opened for the first time. So for the first time, families of limited means had the chance to go on to secondary education. And he learned a lot about electricity and about construction at that time. And that stood him in good stead. Then when he went to work in the cinema, and then he went to wire up houses out in the country when the electricity was coming to the country areas for the first time.
Because the current generation, the closest they'll get to that is the national broadband rollout.
Yeah.
But obviously electricity, that was a lights on situation. Seamus, did you do the most of the questioning?
Yes.
So that's... I presume you were learning, even though you thought you knew everything, learning along the way. I would imagine what's the difficult position here or difficulty is condensing it into the final product, right? So if you've got presumably hours of conversation, how do you edit that down? You want to tell a story. There has to be a narrative, doesn't there?
Correct, Greg. There has to be. And we had a lot of film, a lot of stock. And in truth, I found that aspect of it overwhelming, just that there was that much stuff, that there was that much content kind of thing. So I found that overwhelming, and only for Margaret here, who gradually took to editing and to kind of becoming somewhat expert in that field. So most of that is down to Maggie in terms of kind of finding, we talked throughout it about what the story is that we want to tell, but really Maggie kind of did the late work and kind of and kept chipping away at it to bring out the story that we have now.
Yeah, and it's, I think, you know, it's great for people to reminisce, but I think it's also great for people to get an insight as to what life was like, because, you know, he would have been alive for the onset of the World War II.
Correct.
Different things in our history, cockfighting, boxing, and so Correct. On and so forth, right? The name Great, how did you come up with that, Margaret?
Because when he talked about my mother, he would always say that they were great, you know, as in very close. They would have known each other from the age of about 5 or 6. They grew up within 100 yards of each other. And at that time, all children played on the street. They played football, street cricket, everything.
Yeah. Now, the documentary is going to be screened in the Bala Theatre in Bala Buffet next Monday and Tuesday, the 23rd and 24th of March. It'll be preceded by a short documentary called Crossing Lines. It's the story of Twin Town Harps, with a focus on 1979 when a group of young women formed a football team made up of cross-border and cross-religious players. It's going to be a fantastic couple of days, isn't
it?
And a real great insight into history. Yeah. It's not just the history of one sport and organisation or one individual. It's an insight into all of our history.
It is. And into that period of time, Greg.
Yeah, okay. You've worked with Tom Hannigan and Sean Harkin on this as well.
Yes.
So is that right?
On Crossing Lines, that's right, yes.
Okay, so you've produced both of these?
Well, we were involved in them, in both of these, yes.
Okay. Fantastic stuff.
Yeah.
Right, okay, so 8:30 p.m. is when the curtain goes up. Admission is €10. Children can go free, and proceeds being donated to the Jigsaw Mental Health Support Service for Young People, Animals in Need, Aid, Donegal Aid Sanctuary and Finn Harps FC. And, of course, too, when will the broad... Everyone can't fit into the Bala or can't make those two nights.
Uh-huh.
Is there going to be a publishing of it, generally speaking, where people can watch it, or what's the plan?
I suppose a lot depends on how much interest there is in the film. Uh-huh. What we were hoping was that if there was a lot of interest on the first two nights, that we would run it again.
Yeah, but there's going to be global interest beyond this.
Yes. Oh, yes. And we'll see what will be our plan in the future to put it up on multiple platforms and have it available and accessible for people.
But that makes in festivals as well.
Film festivals.
That makes Monday and Tuesday, though, extra more exclusive because you get to see it first, right? Because there's no schedule for a general release at this point.
No.
Okay, and where can people get more information? Is there a Facebook page, or just phone the Bala, book tickets, turn up in the night?
Yeah, turn up in the night, book the Bala. It's up online now. Anybody can book tickets.
Well done. Thank you so very much for calling over. It sounds fantastic. I really look forward to seeing it. Seamus Gordon, Margaret Gordon, they produced and directed the documentary called Great about their father, Benny Gordon's life. But it's about everybody's life of that time, because while Benny, a very interesting man who obviously has lived a very diverse life, it'll be a familiar story to lots of people of certain generations. Mm-hmm. And you can watch it all from 8:30 in the Bala Theatre next March the 23rd and 24th. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Greg.
And we'll be back with you on Monday. Have a great weekend.